Well, good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, today our guest is William Federer, certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope yours as well. Good evening, Bill. How are you doing?
Well, it's good to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, it's always good to have you, and I understood you were going to tell us the story of Labor Day today.
Well, just shortly, in 1880 was when Labor Day first began. It was up in Chicago, and a little setting of what happened in background. The country, when it was first founded, didn't have any income tax. It had two other kinds of taxes. It had tariff taxes, which was a tax on imports, things brought into the country, and then excise taxes, where you tax specific items. Well, the taxes that helped the northern states hurt the southern states, the tariff taxes. So they would tax imports from Europe, and since the northern states had industries, it made the products from Europe more expensive relatively, and so people would buy the domestic goods and cause their companies to grow. The problem was the South didn't have any factories, and so it now had to buy more expensive goods from Europe or more expensive goods from the northern states. And so that was some of the animosity that led up to the Civil War. Well, after the Civil War, the northern industrialists passed all kinds of tariff taxes, and their factories grew to be immensely powerful and wealthy, and that gave birth to the robber barons, these very wealthy factory owners, the Rockefellers, Carnegies, the J. Paul Gettys, and many of them took advantage of their status and weren't really looking out for the worker. And so it started a class struggle, so to speak. And one of the classic examples was the Pullman Railroad Company. They made railroad cars up in the Chicago area, and they built the apartment complexes for the workers to live in. And they had the grocery stores where the workers shopped, and they paid the workers in company script, not even dollar bills, just coupons, so to speak. And everything was fine until the depression in the late 1880s hit, and sales of railroad cars plummeted. And so the company had to cut back what it was paying the workers. Yet the rent stayed the same, and the groceries stayed the same. So every day the people went to work, they got more indebted to the company that they worked for, and that was the song Tennessee Ernie Ford sang, "I owe my soul to the company store," another day older and deeper in debt. And so that gives you a little picture of the animosity that was growing in America, and they had strikes, and they had railroad strikes, and violence would break out, and Grover Cleveland saw that the workers needed to be appeased, and so he created a Labor Day. Now it's basically just the last day of summer, but back then it was a day to give those that have the working jobs a day off.
But, of course, there was a tremendous effort to organize unions in America to actually counter the power of the employers and to try to have some sort of a balance so that you could have, you know, employees would have rights and employers would have rights. And certainly it's very hard to come up with a balance between the two. Sometimes the unions can become so officious that they'll tend to destroy the employer, and on the other hand, the employers would destroy the union. So somewhere along the line, we had to strike some sort of a happy balance between labor and union so that both could prosper. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, I don't know how far Bill wants to get into the labor movement here in America, but initially it was started by a man named Samuel Gompers. and Samuel Gompers certainly wanted a better opportunity and better rights for laborers. On the other hand, he did not want the socialist system that so many of our people of great wealth seem to be so intent upon, and that word centralizes all power with government. And Samuel Gompers is best known for something he said, and that is that look the world over wherever you will. And wherever you find compulsory government benevolence, you'll find initiative removed from the hearts of men. In other words, whatever a government is going to provide for you from the cradle to the grave, you destroy the initiative of the workers. And so they tried to strike a balance between a free enterprise system and a system where employers could would treat their employees fairly. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, a couple things that the unions did that were good was ending child labor. Instead of, situation in Europe, in England, where you had the Uncle the Oliver Twist and the little child labor, so forth. And so that was ended, and a lot of the forcing of women to work. Of course, nowadays, the women are being forced back into the workplace. Then the 5-day week, 5-day work week, the Sabbath, the Sundays were off all the way from the very founding of America, and because it was the Christian Sabbath. There's even an order that Lincoln gave to his troops that he said that Sunday labor in the Army and Navy should be reduced to the measure of strict necessity because it's the sacred rights of Christian soldiers and sailors, and the best deference for a Christian country that Sunday labor be reduced to strict necessity on the Sabbath. But Saturdays off was one of the things that the unions helped to bring about, so the 2-day weekend. The problem is that overtime increased the cost of manufacturing, which gave birth to the movement of jobs overseas. That's one of the problems today is whenever you increase the minimum wage and increase the cost of manufacturing something in America, then jobs end up going to China and India where the labor costs are cheaper. With Karl Marx, unfortunately, whenever there's a problem, sometimes the answer is worse than the problem.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Federer. And so, Bill, go right ahead. We were just talking about how, of course, there were many things that the labor unions did, like doing with child labor and getting Friday, Saturday off so that they could have a 2-day weekend rather than the 1-day weekend. And these were certainly things that organized labor did, and then getting health care benefits. But health care benefits are a two-edged sword because many times, certainly when you get down to a first dollar coverage, why there tends to be excessive use is one thing about, catastrophe health insurance. So there's another thing about first dollar health insurance, and this creates all sorts of problems and has led really to many of the problems we have in medicine today. And then, of course, Bill talks about, certainly as you put in the minimum wage, why it really sounds great, but as you drive the cost of manufacturing products up, and especially when you removed all of the tariffs, then it would be the most normal thing in the world that our industries would move overseas, and that's exactly what is happening at an increasing rate to the point where a good deal of the industrial base of America is gone. And well over, I don't know whether it's 60-70% of our manufacturing has simply picked up and left America, and we're in real trouble as a result of that. But pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, Karl Marx in the middle 1800s said, "Every man according to his ability, to every man according to his need." Now, that sounded good, in a perfect world, but what it ended up being was an excuse for the poor to steal. But Karl Marx pushed for international communism. And he, of course, his followers overthrew the Tsar in Russia and set up communism there, socialism and communism, which basically turned into an oligarchy, a rule by few. In other words, that supposedly the people own everything, but who's in charge of deciding who gets to live in the nice houses and who gets to live in the dumpy houses? Well, that's the basically it's a gang system, and whoever winds up in charge of dispensing that ends up to be the person in, with power. So it wasn't actually the people owning it; it was boiling down to a gang type of situation. Anyway, the movement in America was one to tax the extreme wealthy. And so, since the Constitution of the United States forbade an income tax, it says Article 1, Section 9, that the federal government shall have no direct taxation of the populace. So there was this push to tax the wealthy, so they allowed an inheritance tax during Teddy Roosevelt's time, because only the extreme wealthy had an inheritance worth leaving. And then they pushed for a corporate income tax, because only the extreme wealthy had a corporate owned corporate stock. Finally, under Woodrow Wilson, he allowed to a tariff bill, he allowed the attaching of a 1% tax on the top 1% richest people in the country. And with the 16th Amendment in 1913 to allow an income tax, even though it was not officially ratified, you know, there's a lot of questions of that. Nevertheless, the public was still in favor of the income tax. Why? Because they never thought they would ever get taxed. It was a soak-the-rich tax. It was just to tax the Rockefellers and Carnegies and these, you know, J. Paul Gettys and these immensely wealthy. Unfortunately, as soon as the income tax was put in place, the extreme wealthy started tax-free foundations, Carnegie Foundation, Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, so they were able to shelter their income and not pay income tax anyway. And then World War I started, and the public allowed themselves to be taxed during the war. And then it was really during World War II that FDR increased the income tax to tax just about the whole populace. And so today, when you see withholding from your paycheck and the income tax being taken out, well, how did that get there? Well, that was a response because of the labor movement to take the soak the rich, you know, take the money from these extreme wealthy, and then it backfired. Now it's taking money from everybody. When you get a background, you get to see some of the things that were happening. Now today, unfortunately, we would like to think that one movement or the other movement has the moral high ground. But unfortunately, the labor movement, for example, in Nevada, the prostitutes have unionized because of health benefits. And I've seen a labor newspaper where they said, well, you may not agree with prostitution, but now there are union brothers and sisters, and we need to stand together with them. And it's like, wait a second, you're willing to compromise your morals and support prostitution because of this? And then you look at the Detroit automakers in the deals that they struck with the unions included that as long as retirement benefits were paid to existing workers, that when the existing workers retired, their jobs would not have to be replaced in America. And that way the car companies could add their factories overseas and cause those to grow. So basically the union workers with their contracts were willing to sell out future union workers and not have the jobs replaced in America as long as they got their retirement. So more or less a selfish me first type of attitude. But we see over time that you know, thankfully the working conditions have improved, but when FDR raised the taxes so high and businesses began to move overseas to get rid of those taxes, it was sort of the Red Rover game when you used to play when you were kids. You know, the kids would stand on one side of a field and hold their hands and say, Red Rover, send Johnny over. And Johnny would try to run across and break through their hands. Well, if he couldn't break through their hands, he had to join their team. And the ones that did, you know, break through, well, they had to go back and forth. And so finally it got down to just, you know, a couple people were left, and they got caught. And what happened is the businesses that moved overseas, they lobbied to remove the tariff taxes so they could bring their goods back into America cheaper. And then the companies that were still in America, they had now tougher competition, and finally they would give up and move overseas, and they would join the team to lobby to remove the tariff taxes so they could bring their goods back into America cheaper. So the factories that were still left in America, they now had more competition, and so many of those gave up and would move overseas and join the other team. And finally, we're at this place where we've disassembled our industrial base so tremendously that it's questionable if we can ever turn it around. I remind you of the Roman Empire right before it fell. It had outsourced all of its grain production to other countries, mostly to North Africa. And when the Vandals came through, that was the name of one of the tribes that overran the Roman borders. When the Vandals came through, they conquered North Africa and cut off the grain supply. And so Rome didn't have enough grain to mount a counterattack. And so they eventually fell. And America today, we've outsourced so many of our jobs that if we ever did get into a military confrontation with China over Taiwan, let's say, all they would have to do is hold their ships back, and our shelves would be empty, and we'd be brought to our knees. And besides, China's the number one purchaser of our national debt, so they could dump that on the market and cause our stock market to crash. Now, the reason they don't is because we're the ones that they sell all the goods to. They sell it to us on credit, but nevertheless, if we go bankrupt, then there's no market for their goods, and their economy would crash. So we're sort of made ourselves, back in the 1950s and 60s, the world planners, the globalists, said that the plan for world peace is to be interdependent, not independent. And so they wanted all the countries to be suppliers and markets for each other. And in a perfect world, yeah, that sounds great, but it leaves out human greed and human ambition. And when it gets to the place where America is totally dependent on all these other countries for their oil and for our, you know, food, and you go to the grocery store and things come in from just about every other country other than America, and all the items you buy at the Walmarts are made in, and they're just about every other country. And of course, we're all disappointed that Walmart has sided with the homosexuals now with their National Gay and Lesbian, the Chamber of Commerce, pushing for gay marriage and so forth. So it might behoove people to decide if they really want to continue shopping there. But nevertheless, we've become so interdependent that we're in a very vulnerable state. Again, very similar to the Roman Empire before it fell. It was in a very vulnerable state. And you know, hopefully we can get some good leadership and turn it around. But there are forces, and I know you've had many guests on your shows that talk about the Council on Foreign Relations and these groups that literally want to get rid of our borders and literally want us to be totally interdependent and get rid of American sovereignty and get rid of the guarantees of our Constitution and, you know, come up with a global government. But it all fits together, you know, the different pieces, but you know, with us just having a celebrated Labor Day, it's always interesting to see how something that, you know, started with good intentions over the period of time has been turned around. And not only has it raised the cost of doing business, which has caused jobs to leave, it's also unaccountable. And that's why, well, there's a lot of concentrated power in the unions, and you have the a lot of organized crime, and, you know, where's Jimmy Hoffa's body buried, and the rigged elections and so forth. So our founders were always leery of concentrated power, whether that power was concentrated in a king or concentrated in the government or concentrated in big business or concentrated in big unions. That's where the danger is, and so they always wanted to set up checks and balances to be sure that the power doesn't get too concentrated.
And, of course, that's unfortunately exactly what is happening today, where a very, very small group of people have been able to gain control of so many of our corporations and banks, and the media is pretty well controlled. Five mega corporations control the media, and ultimately determine, tragically, what most Americans read, what they hear, and what they see on television. We'll be back in just a moment with William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Federer, and of course, Bill's a very good friend and always has something interesting to say about what's going on. We've been talking about Labor Day. And what does Labor Day mean? Well, to most people, it's simply, it's a long weekend. We love long weekends, but people have forgotten that labor is an important part of our economy, a part of our society. And unfortunately, the dignity of labor and even the benefits of labor are rapidly being eroded as more and more of our good-paying jobs go overseas. And I think that we're going to see a gradually shrinking middle class in America. And I fear that very, very soon we'll be in the same sort of a situation that they are in Mexico, where you have a very, very small, extremely wealthy class. You have a gigantic bureaucracy and all sorts of police and military to keep the people in line, and then a great mass of poor people in the country. And increasingly, I think that we're moving in that direction here. And I think we should be concerned about it because, of course, once you destroy the industrial base of a nation, you effectively destroy the wealth of that nation. Pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, it's NAFTA and GATT and these international treaties have not helped any. Matter of fact, I was speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico, there in the state capitol at a conference, and some of the other speakers were from the University of Missouri and the University of Colorado and New Mexico, and they came up with an angle that I hadn't heard before, where the NAFTA treaty, supposedly it was going to have America purchase goods from Mexico, and then Mexico would purchase things from America, but there was nowhere in the treaty that specified the exchange rate. And so no sooner had the treaty gone into effect than Mexico devalued its peso against the dollar. So it made it so, yes, Americans could buy cheaper stuff from Mexico, but now Mexicans would have to pay twice as much to purchase items from America. So consequently, they don't. And so the treaty, which was supposed to have, some equality of you buy some of our stuff and we buy some of yours, now it's just one-sided. Now we buy their stuff and they don't buy any of ours because the treaty, whether intentionally or not, didn't have a stipulation, the exchange rate of the dollar to the peso. But what's happened is, in Mexico, that the NAFTA treaty has allowed the Walmarts and those big companies to sell their goods in Mexico cheaper than they can make them in their own country. So they bring in the Chinese manufactured goods down there, and it's put out of business tens of thousands of Mexican manufacturers. And then the big international grain companies were able to go down and sell their grain cheaper than the Mexicans could grow it with their ox and their plow. And so it's put millions of Mexican farmers out of work, and that gave birth to the migration of so many that want to come across our border. So we basically created the immigration problem through NAFTA.
And of course, NAFTA really is not a treaty. A treaty has to be passed by two-thirds majority. It was just put in as a trade agreement. And yet, of course, it is being used to supersede our own Constitution and to bring our trade relations under the control of an international bureaucracy that I can promise you is no friend at all of the United States or of freedom, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Federer. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for our guest, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And Bill has been talking about this whole process of globalization and pointing out that the NAFTA agreement, you remember they sold NAFTA to us. Oh, we have a positive balance of payment trade balance with Mexico, but things are even going to be better. Look at all those Mexicans down there, 70 million Mexicans. We'll be able to sell them, you know, our refrigerators. We'll be able to sell them, you know, all the things we manufacture here in the United States. And, boy, we're really going to make out great just by trading with Mexico. Well, of course, what happened was we had a very, very soon a negative balance of trade with Mexico. They actually produced, set up a number of factories close to the border, and they were producing cars and other things. They were producing the refrigerators and the other products of that sort, the electrical appliances there. And, of course, it was good for the Mexicans, although they got paid very low wages. It was better than they were making before. But then, of course, our trade policies, as far as our grain is concerned, we simply put so many of the Mexican farmers out of work. And then, they, of course, they became the leaders in this wave after wave after wave of illegal immigration. We literally forced them to come in because they had no means of making a living in their own country. But now, of course, with China on the ascendance and on the rise, so many of the jobs that were in Mexico now are transferring to China. And many of the people who had industrial jobs in Mexico are losing them. And so actually, in many respects, many of the Mexicans are far worse off now than they were before we went there to help them. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Oh, exactly. One of the things when I was speaking there in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of the professors who gave a talk said that they're moving to this, it's almost like communism, where it's a centralized economy, but it's through business. So if they can make stuff cheaper in a certain country, then they have, that's where they'll manufacture that good. And then the other country on the other side of the world, they find a cheaper place to make some other type of item. But what happens is in that little rural native community that used to be self-sufficient. Now, they were subsistence farmers, which means they would just make enough to live off of, but they had everything. They had their little chickens, and they had their little fields. And they, well, once these big companies come in and induce them to produce what they call cash crops, then all the little farmers stop growing the little bits of everything they need to live off of, and they just grow this one crop. And then what happens is that they're no longer self-sufficient, and they have to buy those other goods from the stores. And so it puts the whole world economy on this tenuous type of situation where if any one cog in the wheel fails, then, you know, everybody's going to be brought crashing down. An interesting thing, a lot of the websites nowadays that give a lot of excellent research is Wikipedia. It's an online encyclopedia. And I went on there and typed in trade blocks, trade block, you know, and it pulls up all of the international trade agreements, the Caribbean nation trade agreements, the Southeast Asian nation trade agreements, the you know, the North African country trade agreements, the Pacific Rim countries, and it lists them all, and it talks about how the different regional countries will work together to benefit their own economies and sort of create a little, you know, local trade bloc. And then these trade blocs will work together for a global economy. And it talks about the EU and how those countries all work together and so forth. Well, at the bottom, it has a big graph, and it has columns. And it has one column that says able to travel without a visa. Another one, you know, travel without a passport. Another says, you know, common currency accepted. You know, different trade agreements. And then finally, it says borderless. And under the EU, it says, you know, in force. And under these other countries, under agreement that says proposed, and then it has NAFTA, and it just has the square blank, you know. But it's obvious from seeing this that the goal is to have a borderless situation with Canada and Mexico and North America. And so these planners want there to be no more United States. They want us to be swallowed up in some no regional union, and then finally a global government.
And I think it's so difficult for people to understand that there really are people work at the highest levels of our government who hate America and everything it stands for, because their loyalty is to a New World Order and, of course, a New World Religion. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and once again, our guest this evening is William Federer. We're just talking about what's happening with trade and how this really all started with the labor. And then, of course, as time went by, where they wanted, of course, to be able to get lower labor wages. And you did that by going overseas, but the only way that you could do that was to remove the tariffs, because if we had a 10 or 20 or 30% tariffs on goods coming into this country, why, our industries would be flourishing here. But you see, there are people who really don't want our industries to flourish. Their idea is to build up the economy of the rest of the world. In fact, if you read the Earth Charter, they will tell you that, and this is point 10A of the Earth Charter, they talk about equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. Now, equitable distribution of wealth within nations is basically the concept of communism, as Bill said earlier, to each according, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. In other words, if you, we should have equitable distribution of everything, whether you work for it or not. And then, of course, the second point is equitable distribution of wealth between nations. In other words, they would distribute our wealth to other nations. It's all part of a master plan. The American people are never told what the master plan is, but the Earth Charter is written by three of the wealthiest and most powerful people in the world. And if you have not yet read the Earth Charter and understand it, it involves internationalism and a new spirituality. You need, of course, to go up on the Internet. You can get a copy. It's included in our Financial Tsunami syllabus and in our Sustainable Development syllabus. Or if you want a free copy and can't get one otherwise, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and just request a free copy of the Earth Charter. But you have to understand that everything is going according to plan. Only they haven't told the American people, who are about to be impoverished, that there is a master plan. And this thing is happening at a fantastically rapid rate. And every year we lose more and more of our jobs, and more of our major factories close and move overseas, and more of our people see their hopes and dreams and the future of their children and an opportunity leaving this country. And every year more people come in from other countries with special visas. They're qualified in engineering, they're qualified in electrical things, they're qualified, let's say, in computers, and they'll work for far less. And so they get American jobs, and we see the living standards of the average American gradually declining. Just a little bit imperceptibly, but year after year after year. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Federer. And Bill, William, why don't you pick up the story there?
Well, one of the things I think is interesting, if you know, for example, that a highway is going to go through a piece of farmland, if you know about that ahead of time, you can go out and buy the farmland, and then when the highway comes through, gee, you've got frontage property, and you become wealthy. Well, let's take it another step. Let's say that you can pull the strings in government to have the highway go through your farmland. Well, what's happened is internationally, America has had the wealth, and if you know, or you can pull the strings to get the treaties and the tariffs reduced so that you can bring in your goods from Malaysia or these different places cheaper, then the wealth is transferred to you. And so we see that there is this immense transfer of wealth from America to people that own the businesses in different countries around the world. But also, you know, Karl Marx, mentioned him earlier, he had his communism, the philosophy behind it, spread around the world. And one of the ways he would teach to do this is through the use of, you know, dialectics, the idea that you look for a crisis or you fan the flames of a crisis so that people will be willing to let go of their rights and freedoms in order to have the crisis solved. And the 40 or 50 some odd countries that fell to communism, the idea was that whether it was the rich against the poor, the blacks against the whites, the Christians against the Muslims, the Catholics against the Protestants, they really didn't care who the two sides were. They just wanted violence to break out, and then everybody would be willing to let go of their rights and freedoms in order to have the violence stopped. And so it was a way to get people to give up their freedoms. And, you know, it was an old, is a Machiavelli, you know, in Italy, in the 500 years ago, it had all these little princedoms and dukedoms, and, you know, Genoa, Italy was its own kingdom, and Venice was its own kingdom, and there was all the infighting. And a guy named Niccolo Machiavelli said, gee, if one prince could control all the kingdoms in Italy, it would stop all the infighting. And so he wrote a book called The Prince for Lorenzo de' Medici, and in there he said, you know, if a prince wanted to conquer a village and the people did not want him to, if he goes in there and conquers them, the people will hate him. But if the prince pays someone to go in and burn barns and kill cows and create crises, then the people will cry out for help and the king will march in there and kill the person that he paid and restore peace, and the people will treat him like a hero. But the bottom line is he'll end up controlling that village. And so it's the idea the ends justifies the means. So it's the prince can do all these terrible things if the end result is him getting more power, because if he can become ultimately powerful and control all of Italy, it'll stop all the infightings between all these little kingdoms that are always fighting each other. And it's really good marketing technique. You know, you create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher, and they'll pay anything for it, and you'll be glad that they were there to sell you the fire extinguisher. And so whenever you see global politics, there's always a dialectic, there's always a triangle, there's always, you know, three different, you know, pieces, at least three different pieces in the puzzle, and you know, they're genuine threats. And so today, when we add in the globalist movement, but then you add in the Islamic terrorist threat, which is a legitimate threat. These are people that the Wahhabi sect in particular, but they definitely hate the West and they definitely want to kill us. And so when we see that, yes, we need to fight that threat, and yes, we need to catch the terrorists, but you know, it's sort of a catch-22 because we're giving up some of our freedoms in order to do that. And, you know, there's really no way out other than the individuals in the country arming themselves with knowledge and with wisdom and with insight to be able to navigate through this. But with the, you know, the bringing up of the Islam situation, I thought it would be interesting, Dr. Stan. I have before me an article from the Washington Post. Now, the Washington Post is usually got a liberal slant to it, but this is a very interesting article that came out just this past May 21st. And the title of it was quotes from Saudi textbooks after the intolerance was removed. The title was, "This is a Saudi textbook after the intolerance was removed." And the reviewer had read through official Saudi textbooks used in Saudi Arabian schools. And now it's important to realize that Saudi Arabia is the number one financier of mosques being built around the world. 9 out of the 10 mosques in America are Saudi-financed mosques. And so these are the textbooks that are being taught there. It says, Christians are from swine, Jews are from apes. It says that every other religion other than Islam is false. And here's a fourth grade textbook. It says, true belief means that you hate the polytheists and the infidels. So they're teaching them that, you know, true belief means that they're supposed to hate the infidels. And, of course, the Quran in Surah 5:17 says, infidels are those who believe that God is Christ, the Son of Mary. Another place it says, infidels are those who believe that God is one of three in a trinity. And so it defines Christians and Jews as infidels. Here's a fifth grade textbook. Again, this is a quote from the Washington Post. The fifth grade Saudi textbook said, "Whoever obeys the prophet and accepts the oneness of Allah cannot maintain a loyal friendship with those who oppose Allah and his prophet, even if they are his closest relatives." So it basically says that they cannot be friends with you. And so that's why in the Quran it says, "Believers make not friends with Jews nor the Christians." That's one of the reasons that we'll never have peace in the Middle East, because as soon as we get a treaty between the Jews and the Muslims, the fanatical sect of Islam says we've just offended Allah by making peace, by making a loyalty or a friendship with the infidels, and they can't wait to break the treaty. Here's another quote from the fifth grade textbook. It says, "It is forbidden for a Muslim to be a loyal friend to someone who does not believe in Allah and his prophet." So it's forbidden for them to be a friend. It reminds me of a story of a college student in the Houston area, and he was Jewish, and his roommate was Muslim, and they were on the soccer team together, and they really got along, and one day his Muslim friend said, "You know, gee, you're such a nice guy, it's too bad someday I may have to kill you." and they do it not because they want to, but they feel like they're being obedient to Allah, and that they are required to be obedient to Allah and kill the infidel if a jihad is called. Here's another quote from the Saudi textbooks, quoted in the Washington Post. It says, "A Muslim, even if he lives far away, is your brother in religion. Someone who opposes Allah, even if he is your brother or your family, is your enemy." So, again, here's a sixth grade textbook. It says, "Just as Muslims were successful in the past when they came together in sincere endeavor to evict the Christian crusaders from Palestine, so will the Arabs and the Muslims emerge victorious, Allah willing, against the Jews and their allies if they stand together and fight." So when the Muslims only respect strength, and so when you leave, to them that's an encouragement. And so when the Crusades left, and also when Hezbollah in Lebanon blew up the Marine barracks and killed 240 Marines, and Ronald Reagan's response was to pull our Marines out, to them that was a great encouragement. As much as I appreciate and respect Ronald Reagan, he's one of my favorites. But looking back, hindsight's 2020. You know, we should have gone in there then and rooted out Hezbollah. But here's an eighth grade textbook. It says, as cited in Ibn Abbas, and it's I-B-N-A-B-B-A-S, it says, as cited in Ibn Abbas, the apes are Jews, the people of the Sabbath, while the swine are the Christian, the infidels of the communion of Jesus. So here they are teaching kids in school that the apes are Jews and that the swine are Christian.
Well, of course, the thing is, Bill, that who is keeping the Saudi government in power? And that is, we are. Why would we keep a government in power that was teaching such terrible, terrible things? And who is it who brought these crazy Iranian mullahs to power in Iran? Why, the Central Intelligence Agency toppled the Shah back in 1979 and brought the mullahs to power, and they knew full well that they were behind the bombing of the American embassy in Beirut in 1983 and the American barracks there that killed, I think, 241 Americans. They knew the bombing was coming ahead of time, according to a book we carry called See No Evil by Robert Baer. And yet we did absolutely nothing about that. We knew, for instance, that probably the taking down of Pan Am 103, the Lockerbie bombing, was an Iranian thing. We did nothing about that. Why would we be doing nothing and waiting until just this time in history when suddenly we're talking about attacking Iran? And, I mean, you have to sort of wonder if there's something else behind what's going on.
Yeah, that's that dialectic. That's that triangle. That's that... Hitler was a genuine threat, but as the world united against him, it gave birth to the United Nations. And so that's why the United Nations came into being, saying, we want to make sure that we don't have any more of these, you know, international terrible regimes. And so we create this organization. Well, the organization ends up being worse. The problem, the answer is worse than the problem.
Right. And we have a real problem with, you know, with this radical form of Islam, which is being pushed by the Wahhabi faith, which is being financed by our good friends, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. In fact, I don't know if you've seen these pictures of George Bush walking hand in hand with one of these Saudi princes, holding hands together. You know, it's a book, the House of, I've forgotten the name of the book now, but, you know, so the Bush family has been very close to the Saudi family that is pushing these radical forms of Islam. And yet, President Bush says, we've got to do something about this radical form of Islam. There's so many inconsistencies. And what's the solution? I mean, are we going to kill all the Arabs? I mean, that's the only way I can see that, you know, you'll ever have peace in the Near East, you know, certainly between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Is that a Christian approach to take?
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting is Teddy Roosevelt, in 1916, wrote a book, and you know, and I do feel, you know, I don't know everything that you know, Dr. Stan, but I think that President Bush is, well, a lot of areas I am very pleased with him, and then there's many areas I'm not, and the areas with you know, calling Islam a religion of peace, and with our open borders and the globalist thing is definitely an area that I'm not pleased with. But this was a quote from Teddy Roosevelt, and in 1916 he wrote a book called Fear God and Take Your Own Part. And listen to this, it's very interesting. Again, this is President Teddy Roosevelt. He says, Christianity is not the creed of Asia and Africa at this moment, solely because the 7th century Christians of Asia and Africa had trained themselves not to fight, whereas the Muslims were trained to fight. Christians were saved in Europe solely because the people of Europe fought. If the people of Europe in the 7th and 8th centuries, up to and including the 17th century, had not possessed a military equality with and gradually a growing superiority over the Mohammedans who invaded Europe, Europe would at this moment be Mohammedan, and the Christian religion would be exterminated. Wherever the Mohammedans have had complete sway, wherever Christians have been unable to resist them by the sword, Christianity has ultimately disappeared. From the hammer of Charles Martel to the sword of Sobieski, John Sobieski was a Polish leader. It says, from the hammer of Charles Martel to the sword of Sobieski, Christianity owed its safety in Europe to the fact that it was able to show it could and would fight as well as the Mohammedan aggressor.
And I think that's absolutely right. I think that the Europeans were defending themselves against invaders, but what are the people of Iraq doing and Afghanistan doing today? Aren't they defending themselves against an aggressor? I mean, they look upon America as an aggressor. Maybe if we pulled out of there, we might not have all this animosity and growing hatred for America. Certainly, I think we should defend ourselves, but are we really defending ourselves by attacking Afghanistan to catch Osama bin Laden and then forgetting to catch Osama bin Laden and then attacking Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction and then turns out that they, at least we couldn't find any, and now we're going to invade Iran because, of course, they may be able to develop nuclear weapons, even though the CIA says it'll be 5 to 10 years before they may develop them. I mean, are we the aggressor? Do they have a right to defend themselves against us and maybe even to counterattack? I think we should fight to defend our country. But are we defending our country in what we're doing in Europe today, in the Middle and Near East today? That's the real question.
Yeah, it's something that there's not an easy answer to because, you know, again, the Muslims definitely do hate us. I mean, as I was reading those quotes from the textbooks, I mean, they definitely have ingrained it into the minds of the 90% of the mosques in America that are financed through the Saudis, that you know, that Americans are the enemies.
Why do we let the Saudis bring money in to build a mosque in our country to create hatred for America? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it doesn't, and it's almost like, you know, again, you picture that triangle that, you know, that there has to be a crisis in order for people to surrender their freedoms to solve the crisis. You know, I mean, it doesn't belittle the fact that the crisis is real, but unfortunately, the answer to solving the crisis has been presented is us giving up freedoms, for example, being strip searched at the airport. You know, I remember years ago when I traveled in Europe and they would, you know, look through all your luggage and I thought, boy, I can't wait to get back to America where you can just, well, now it's just as bad over here. And so because of the crisis, we're losing these freedoms. But I do believe the only thing that these radical Muslims respect is strength, and they need to be defeated so that they will be put back into the Middle Ages where they belong.
Well, I mean, are we going to take on Pakistan? And what about Saudi Arabia and Egypt? And, you know, because these are all Muslim countries. We're going to be back in just a moment here with our good friend, William Federer. Well, Bill, the question is, how far should we go? Should we? Do you think we should attack Iran? And what about Saudi Arabia? Certainly, they're one of the major forces behind this whole incredible situation.
Well, there's a long answer and a short answer. The short.
You've got 3 minutes to answer.
The long-term answer is we need to stop feeding the dragon. We do need to come up with alternative sources of energy and be energy independent, not interdependent. Because we've been financing it. In 1924, when oil was discovered over in Saudi Arabia, our money flowed over there, and it went to that Wahhabi sect, and that Wahhabi sect has been using the money that we're giving them to finance their radical belief around the world. That's the long-term answer. The short-term is, again, they only respect strength, and it's like when finally Hiroshima happened, it caused the radical Emperor Hirohito to say, okay, we give up. And it disheartened the entire movement, and they were able to, you know, come up to the 20th century. It's like the radical Islamic movement needs to be disheartened, needs to be run up against a brick wall. It needs to be dealt with firmly. Because whether America's doing what we're doing or not, they're still wanting to take over Europe. They're still wanting to establish Sharia law in different cities whenever they're allowed. They need to be dealt with firmly on an international scale, like Teddy Roosevelt said. And then we can come back to the bargaining table. It's like a bully on a playground. If you show weakness, it just encourages them. So however we gotten to this point, which really you can draw the finger back to for a couple of generations, but Bill Clinton was key in allowing a lot of this these problems to go unanswered. You know, when they blew up embassies and so forth, and we didn't respond. But now we're in this position, and we do need to show strength. And above it all, God is still on the throne, and we need to pray and repent of our sins, and hopefully He'll have mercy and turn this around.
Well, I certainly couldn't agree with you more, Bill. It's always a pleasure. Bill, would you like to get your website out and information about how people get in touch with your ministry?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. My website's AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com, and people can sign up for a free daily email there or buy any of my books. And I have a toll-free number. It's 1-888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. And it's always an honor to be on with you, Dr. Stan, and you and your wife, Barbara, are just tremendous friends.
Hold just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Bill, I want you to give your website out one more time and your telephone number.
It's AmericanMinute.com, and I also have a book by the title American Minute and little things on each day in American history, and some of them deal with the Islamic situation, and some of them deal with the tax situation and so forth. And AmericanMinute.com, and then the toll-free number is 888-USA-WORD, 888 USAWORD.
Well, God bless you, Bill, and thank you so very much for being with us on this Labor Day evening here at 2006. Good night. God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I do hope you've enjoyed our conversation with William Federer. And, of course, you know, we've got a great program coming in this next hour with our good friend Ron Brown, and I hope that some of you are out there listening tonight, our regular listeners out across America. You'll certainly want to get a copy of our latest newsletter, which is going to begin a series of newsletters on what really happened on the morning of 9/11. Most people have a totally confused approach to that, and so you can't really explain what's going on in one newsletter. You have to have a series of newsletters. So we started the first, the August newsletter, and we'll probably do September and October, and I think you'll be fascinated as we go into the background of how we got to where we are today and where we're headed. But I will tell you one thing. The present administration is intent upon taking America into World War III and attacking Iran and Syria and really, of course, plunging America into what I believe will be a nuclear holocaust, which really doesn't make any sense. 61% of the American people oppose what's going on in Iraq, but the administration really doesn't care because they don't believe in democracy. They have an agenda, and I really believe that they are being drawn into expanding the war in the Middle East by totally irrational and unexplainable forces. Forces, perhaps, which you will understand better after you've read my August and September and October newsletters. Anyway, if you'd like to get a free copy of our August newsletter, you can request it now, or just if you'd like a regular newsletter, you'd like to understand the immigration issue, I think our May newsletter is probably one of the better newsletters we've got, because it talks not only about the consequences of illegal immigration and the resulting multicultural and multilingual society that it fosters, but it also goes into who's really behind this, and what is behind the people who are pushing illegal immigration. And it will take you into the mysterious logo of the Trilateral Commission. The mysterious logo of the Trilateral Commission. You'll certainly want to get a copy of our May newsletter. Now, you can pull that down off the Internet by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you a free copy. If you can't get to our website at radioliberty.com, that's radioliberty.com. We do hope that many of you want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, that you want to get our books on the supernatural, that you want to get our three pamphlet set on the occult hierarchy. You really need to get this and read it and study it, because, of course, it's not only what I have been able to glean, but several essays written by Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who I believe is the finest researcher we have in the nation today. And so if you would like to get a free catalog, maybe you'd like to get a health catalog, of course, we'd be glad to send you one free of charge. If you call us at 1-800-544-8927, and we do carry a line of other vitamins and minerals and various supplements that my wife and I take on a regular basis, the magnesium and selenium and vitamin C and D and quercetin, and we're even going to be carrying some oil of oregano, all of these things which people should be stocking up on now as we move towards World War III. If you don't have a Berkey water filter, why you'd need to have one, we do carry them. And, of course, if you buy them through us, why you'll get a free four-tape set, a free video that we produced as an incentive. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, there is no way that this nation will survive. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back in just a moment with Ron. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, this evening our guest for the second hour is going to be Ron Brown, and of course Ron is certainly supports Radio Liberty. He's sells gold and silver, but I always enjoy our conversations, and certainly I consider him a good friend. I've never met him, but I've talked to him so many times. I've talked to him a lot more than I talked to many of the old friends I've had back through the years. And so I think that it's important that you really have a grasp of what's going on in the world today, because I think we're certainly on the verge of some very, very serious consequences, especially if we move ahead with the war against Iran as is planned. Now, it certainly is very interesting as we see what's happening to the price of oil. As I pointed out many times before, there is no shortage of oil in the world. There's plenty of oil. In fact, Saudi Arabia has the ability to increase the price of oil, and they didn't want to drive the price up as high as it went, but it was driven up by the people who own the five major oil companies in the world, and that's Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, BP, which is controlled by the British royal family, and Royal Dutch, which is controlled by the royal family of Holland. So, but now suddenly, the price of oil is dropping. The price of gasoline is coming down, and we have to ask if there was no reason for the price to go up other than manipulation and profit. And we know they made a profit. They made the year before last. Oil companies made $25 billion. Last year they made, $100 billion. That's a $75 billion additional profit they made this last year. Why is the price of oil going down now? Well, I believe it's basically because they have a deal with the administration. They want the price down before the election so the people will feel good. People, if the economy is good, people will feel good. If the economy is bad, people feel bad. And if the price of oil is high and gasoline is high, people are concerned. If the price falls before the election, why, people will feel much more kindly towards the current administration, won't they? Could it possibly be that crass and calculated and manipulative? And I would like to suggest, I believe that's exactly what's happening. I believe the stock market is manipulated. I believe that the price of gold and silver are manipulated, although they're having difficulty controlling them. And now, of course, even some of the commodities are getting out of their control, as we see the price of copper higher than I've seen in almost 40 years, as we're seeing the price of nickel going up to $12 to $14 a pound. And well, let's get right back to our special guest this evening. You don't want to hear me talk. We want to hear what Ron has to say. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
How you doing, Dr. Stan?
I'm doing fine.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just listening to what you're saying, and, I'm not an expert on the oil. There's strong arguments that we've reached peak oil, and a lot of the major oil fields are going into decline. I'm not an expert on that, so I couldn't really comment, but I have no doubt that on the short term things are manipulated for different purposes, and I would imagine the election would be one of them. But there's no doubt the shortage growing in all the base commodities, with the growth of China and India and all of Asia coming into the 21st century, and their build and boom is just continues. We're running real short, like you say, on copper. I was just reading on nickel supplies have fallen from 35,000 tons in February to less than 6,000 tons today. So that's nickel.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ron Brown. We're talking about what's happening in the commodities. Ron is saying that the price of nickel has gone up, and it really has gone up phenomenally. And, of course, it's, $12, $14 a pound, something ridiculous like that?
Some in that neighborhood. I don't really track it on a daily basis, but we know all the base metals are going up ridiculously in price. And there's experts that study this that are saying it'll last at least another two to 8 years. So I think we're in the very early stages of this bull market in base metals, and it's just going to be exacerbated by the growing inflationary pressures as more and more central banks are forced to print money faster and faster and faster to keep their economies from going into an implosion. And, of course, that inflated money supply goes in and drives the prices of all things up.
And I really think it's fascinating as we see what's happening today. And we realize, of course, the amount of money that's out there in hedge funds. And I don't know, Ron, whether you had a chance to read that article I referred you to, but I was amazed to find that the managers of the 26 leading hedge funds. Now, the hedge funds are these large amounts of money you get into. You put in, probably minimum investments, a couple of hundred thousand. But, of course, then these funds are really out there on the front lines making sometimes very risky investments, but the profits really they can make are phenomenal. And the leader, men who control the 26 leading hedge funds in the world, on average last year made $336 million each. $333 million each. That's even better. Almost as good as the president of Enron did when he retired.
Well, you slightly underestimated. You misread it. It's $363
million. Oh, $363. Well, I'm very conservative, Ron. You've got the article there. I'm just going by my memory. Anyway, it's an awful lot of money. And, of course, these hedge funds are taking phenomenal risks, and they're investing in debenture futures. Now, debentures is, I should say, derivative futures. Derivatives is bad enough, but you start getting into derivative futures, and I don't think anybody understands that other than there's a lot of money to be made there. And they're investing frantically in it. The only trouble, there's a lot of money to be lost there as well. And as certainly Warren Buffett said, derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction, currently latent but potentially lethal. And I think Warren Buffett's a pretty smart guy. And if these things ever start to come unraveled, why, the whole house of cards that's holding up the world financial system could begin to come tumbling down like the World Trade Center. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, Ron Brown, and we're talking about really what's going on in the world markets. And of course, we see gold really not doing very much today. It's just taking about 625, but silver's certainly taken a turn for the upside, hasn't it?
Sure has. It's actually reached $13 today overseas, so it's made a pretty good recovery from that amazing sell-off back in May when it broke down below $10, I think as low as $9.50, and here we are right back up at $13. And I suspect in September or October we will re-challenge the old $15 high. It was about where it peaked out in May. And once we break through there, I think you'll make a mad dash towards $20, $25 an ounce, and that could easily happen by next spring.
And I've heard this from other experts as well. So I think that we're on the edge of something very, very big as far as silver is concerned. We'll just have to wait and see what happens to gold, because the central banks do not want the price of gold to go up. Why? Because they don't want you to have anything that you can trade that is of intrinsic value. And that's what Alan Greenspan said in his classic article back in 1966. The battle against gold is an effort to make sure you have no means to protect your wealth. And if there is any other means besides gold to take away your wealth, why, the welfare status would take that away as well. So this is all part, I believe, of a planned program to impoverish the American people. And when this house of cards come down, most people, I believe, are going to get wiped out. Well, I was reading this article I'd referred to. It's amazing as we see how much of the industrial base of America has already been lost. And if you don't have an industrial base, then what is the basis of the wealth of the nation?
Exactly.
Well, now, of course, the thing is that are you seeing many people really very interested in buying gold and silver today? Are they sort of sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what's going to happen?
Well, you know, business really picked up the first 4 or 5 months of the year. It was just really exploding, the best business I've had probably since back in the Y2K days, 99. And then when the collapse came, it scared people. That's exactly what it was designed to do. They create these very fast sell-offs, a panic sell-off, where silver drops from $15 to $9.50 in 2 weeks. And obviously, to the conservative investor out there, that's so volatile that they're easily talked out of getting back in. So, yeah, people just kind of back off and want to look and see what's going to happen. And, of course, they'll wait till it breaks through 15, goes through 16, because people always buy when it's going up. They don't buy when you have the opportunity.
Now, of course, the thing to do really is just buy and hold and hold and hold and hold and until you really think we've reached the top. And I don't know how we'll know what that is. Maybe Ron will be able to tell us, but it's got a long way to go, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. You know, what I tell people is, you know, what's really going on in the world today is that the whole world has been inflating. And, of course, the U.S. has caused much of that. But now we're in the process that the United States is being, or at least the United States dollar, is slowly being rejected and repudiated as the world's reserve currency. So here we are, a nation, as you've pointed out so many times, that we need $2.5 billion of foreign money coming into our markets every day, and yet foreigners are now seeing us as a bad risk, and they're backing off. I was just reading before we went on there that in April, foreigners only bought $58 billion worth of our debt, which is way below what they normally would buy. So as the foreigners cut us off, and since the United States has no savings, we can't fund our deficits and debts internally. It's forcing the Federal Reserve to start printing money faster and faster to buy up that unwanted paper. So what it's really doing is that the tiger is chasing his tail, and the dollar is starting to get weaker and weaker. And the final point is, if the dollar is heading towards zero, which it is, then gold and silver and other commodities are heading towards infinity. Now, at what point will gold go in terms of dollars? It just depends on how far the dollar drops.
I think it's really so interesting. Today I spent a little time trying to track down some articles by Stephen Roach, who was quoted in the article we referred to earlier today. And I did get something that Stephen Roach had written, and I think it was May or June, and where he was talking about the fact that now, of course, the amount of money we have to borrow every single day is $3 billion. I remember when it was $2 billion, then it was $2.5 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking over a year or two. Now we're up to having to borrow $3 billion every day from other countries just to keep our economy going, just to pay off the debts that the government has. Because, of course, we've cut the taxes, we've increased spending, and that is a formula for disaster. You can't cut income and increase. Maybe, of course, they'll argue, well, we have actually increased income by cutting taxes, and that is really true. But the trouble is they've increased the spending far more than they've increased the income, and it doesn't matter how you cut it. I mean, if your outgo exceeds your inflow, why, you're in real trouble year after year after year. And right now we're up to $3 billion a day we have to borrow from other countries simply to pay our debts. So this, to me, is a recipe for disaster. And then, as of course the experts are talking about, the hedge funds, there are, I mean, trillions of dollars in hedge funds investments out there, and probably several hundred trillion dollars in derivatives, and there's not that much money in the world. And if these things ever start to go, it'll be like a cascade, like pushing over the first domino, and then all the other dominoes begin to fall. What did you think of that article? Did you have a chance to read it, Rod?
Yeah, I did. You know, I think the interesting thing about that, especially the point where you have the 26 leading hedge funds that earned an average of $363 million each, those managers get paid on their profits. So that encourages the investors or the managers to make more and more risky investments, and since you're doing it with such highly leveraged money that was made possible by this liquidity that's being pumped into the system to keep it alive, all that money is now going into mass speculation. You know, they talk about the 29 Depression and the speculation that was going on then. Well, I tell you, what's going on today makes that look like child's play. So, yeah, we've created an absolute monster, and the IMF and the people like that who normally control monetary events are losing control because of all this money that's outside of their control.
And I really think that people have to realize that we're on the verge. I don't know what is going to happen. It could happen in a matter of weeks, or it could happen in a matter of months, or it could happen in a year or two. But, you know, as Paul Volcker said in his article last year in the Washington Post, I mean, sooner or later, with a bang or with a whimper, this thing is going to come down. And so I think that it's important that people begin making their preparations now. One of the biggest problems we have is that everybody is overextended. So many people, more on their house than their house is worth, and certainly as the value of houses begins to drop, and even here where I'm living in the Monterey Bay area, which is one of the most desirable areas, though this last month, the price of the average home has actually begun to come down. And, of course, as I drive home every day, I go past a trailer park, and I notice about six signs up there for trailers that are for sale. There used to be maybe one or two. Now there's six. And, of course, they're just not selling. So this is beginning. We're beginning to see what happens when the housing market begins to cut back and the air is let out of the bubble. And this has happened. This is what happened in Japan. At one time, the property value of the property in the city of Tokyo was equal to the property value of all the land in the United States. Now, of course, it really wasn't worth that, but that was what the expectations were because, of course, the Japanese stock market had gone to 40,000, and everybody was expecting it to go to 100,000. My neighbor's a stockbroker, and he was just so excited that the Japanese stock market was on the way to 100,000. Well, it really wasn't. It was on the way back to 10,000 because their stock market lost 75% of its value. But the property value, in Japan fell up to 90%. And the people who had bought extensive property or invested in expensive property or had borrowed on expensive property suddenly found that, of course, they were impoverished. And that's why, of course, in Japan today, their savings rate is so high. They don't want to invest. They don't want to buy. They want protection. The trouble is, here in America, we don't have any savings. We have a negative savings rate. Most people have no cushion. And, of course, when the air goes out of the housing bubble, and, of course, when the jobs begin to cut back, and as the stock market begins to fall, it will sooner or later, why, of course, these people are going to be just standing there, like playing musical chairs. When the music stops and the chairs are all gone, you're out of the game. What are your thoughts, Ron?
Well, you know, when the high-tech bubble busted in the 2000, it did severe damage to the speculators in that market. Some of them lost up to 90% just in a matter of a month or two. But, you know, the amount of people investing in the stock market compared to the amount of people that have been involved in the real estate market, because we all want to own a house, it dwarfs what happened in the stock market bubble or the high-tech bubble. So when this real estate bubble does accelerate to the downside, it's really literally going to take no prisoners, you know, especially out in California, and in fact it spilled over across the whole country, even down in New Mexico where I was living. You were having all this California money come out, and they would actually drive into new subdivisions, and they would have junkets and take them in there, and people would buy 3, 4, 5 houses just for investment. Now, if people are buying a house to live in, then they will do everything they can to maintain that house. But if you've gotten caught up in the speculative bubble in real estate and you've taken your borrowed against the equity in your existing houses and go out and start buying other houses, high leverage, you know,
you're in real trouble. Hold that thought. Okay, go ahead, John. Run.
So once this thing takes off, the people that are buying real estate for investment are going to be forced to sell in a panic, and when that happens, the world, the market will be just literally glutted with houses, because literally what you've done is create a false demand for houses, because about 30% of all the houses sold, we'll figure out here, were just for investment only. So that's an excess supply of houses on the market, and as soon as the bubble pops, then all that real estate goes unwanted.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting. A lot of people I know, you know, they're not very sophisticated people, but they think they are. And what they have done is they borrowed, large sums of money, maybe on their home or whatever it be, at 4 or 5%. And you could lend that money out to developers, at 12%. And they go ahead and build a house, and then they pay you back when the house is sold. So you borrow at 4 or 5%, you lend out at 12%, to the builders, the men who speculated in building houses, and you really come out like a, you know, really great. I know one of my friend's sons is talking about retiring, but what happens if those houses that you have financed with your investments, what happens if they don't sell? I mean, your security is in those houses, but if you have your security is guaranteed by a house that doesn't sell, then what do you do? And you've got to pay back the interest that you borrowed. You've got to pay back the money that you borrowed. And, of course, as interest rates goes up, you're going to have to pay a higher rate on that. But, of course, I think an awful lot of people who think they're very sophisticated, and they've done very well in the past, but they don't understand the economic cycles, and they really get stuck. And I can remember, back in, I think it was 1980, when a lot of my doctor friends were, you know, they were going to really make a killing. They went out and borrowed a lot of money, and they built condominiums, and they built apartment houses, and they built beautiful townhouses out along the ocean there. Maybe a development of 30 beautiful townhouses would sell each for, you know, a quarter of a million or $300,000 or $400,000. And they were really beautiful, well-built houses, a beautiful location, but suddenly as the interest rate began to rise higher and higher, and remember, the interest rates at that time went up to 19%. Most people couldn't qualify for a loan, and most people didn't have the money. And here are these doctors sitting there with these beautiful things that are just going to make all this money. They're motivated by greed, and suddenly they're motivated by fear. Because, of course, they really are very, very concerned that they may not be able to, pay the interest on the loans, and eventually they lost the whole thing.
You know, I had my brother had a father-in-law back in the 60s. He was a self-employed man, so he didn't have a pension to look forward to. So he decided the way he would retire would be to start developing rent houses. And he bought one and was doing well, and real estate went up a little bit, so he borrowed on the equity and got another one. And after about 5 or 10 or 15 years of this, he was up to over 30 houses, thinking he was in good shape. And that was when the 80s hit. And when the real estate bubble popped there, it started downhill. And within 6 months, he lost every one of those houses, because once it started down, all these leveraged loans started to come in, and he couldn't meet the payment, so he was just forced out of every one of them. And see, that was mild compared to what we've seen in this real estate bubble the last 5-6 years.
Oh, that's right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ron Brown. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And we'd love to hear from you if you have a question or comment. A lady just called in from Marina who has 6 houses, 3 of which are for sale, and they've now been sitting empty for 4.5 months. And, you know, how long can she continue holding out? And this is what happens to people who do not understand the economic cycles. And we've been pleading with people to understand what was coming down the line. And of course, you know, your city house is sitting empty, and you've got to pay the interest rates on them, the rent to the bank every month. And eventually comes the time when you run out of money. That's what the plan is. And you see the transfer of wealth from weak hands to strong hands. And unfortunately, I fear that this is going to happen. I think that the people who are manipulating this whole thing are know exactly what they're doing. Now, I thought one of the interesting points in this article, and incidentally, it's an article in Counterpunch that somebody sent me today, and it quoted a professor, I think his name is Kolkow, is it K-O-L-K-O?
K-O-L-K-O, isn't it?
K-O-L-K-O. But he was saying that the Bank for International Settlements, which is the in Basel, Switzerland, that they have put out a report, and they apparently are expressing great concern about what's happening financially, and they are concerned that this massive amount of liquidity we have out here with nothing behind it, we built a house of cards built on sand, and they're afraid that the hurricane is coming, and you know what happens to a house of cards built on sand when the hurricane hits. So the impression I got was that there are some very, very wise and intelligent and well-educated people who are very, very concerned about what is going to happen next.
Well, you know, it goes back to what we've been talking about for the last, how long have I been going on the air with you, Dr. Stanton?
About 4 or 5 years now, it seems.
It's been that long, gosh. But we've been talking about how this debt structure, is spinning out of control, and the higher the debt structure gets, the more desperate the monetary authorities have to act in order to keep the thing from collapsing, and as I've characterized it as a Ponzi scheme, they must keep it growing at all cost. And as they do that, then you get more and more risk being built into the market. More and more risk is people are willing to take higher risk because they feel like the government's going to bail it out and they won't let anything collapse, so they go way beyond any prudent type of investing, and that's where we are. And now all of a sudden the monetary authorities are scared to death because it's spinning out of their control. And, of course, they're the ones that created the inflationary liquidity in the first place.
Okay, a listener called and said, won't massive inflation save people's investments? Well, they'll have higher and higher investments that will be worth less and less. Go ahead. Do you have a thought on that? Won't massive inflation keep this thing from collapsing?
Well, it has been keeping it from collapsing, but the problem is, the vast majority of the population, their incomes do not keep up with the cost of living. So even though they're making more and more money and they're holding the markets together temporarily, the people are falling further and further behind. And, you know, a perfect example, my next-door neighbor, he went out and refinanced his house about a year and a half, 2 years ago in order to start a little business venture. Well, that failed. Then he decided in order to get out of the jam he was in, he would put the house on the market, but you hit it on the nose. He called the real estate agent out, and they said, there's no way you can sell your house anywhere close to what you owe on it. And so more and more people are getting squeezed by this stagflation, in effect. They're inflating the money supply, but people's incomes is not keeping up. So eventually it will collapse, just as it did back in 78, 79.
And so I think it's so important that people begin making preparations, get out of debts, quit spending. It is the fact that we're spending so much money that has got so many people overextended their credit card debt, the student loans, the borrowing on the house, you know, so that you could have a new car or a new boat or you could take a nice vacation. But, of course, the trouble with borrowing is you got to repay the money. And, you know, if you have something that you put up for equity, and believe me, they're not going to lend you anything unless you have security, why, of course, you can get into real, real problems in times like this. And so our play is understand what's going on. We have a syllabus we call the coming financial tsunami. And, of course, it's got a talk and a syllabus with it. If you can afford it, fine. If not, it certainly would be. You get our little pamphlet called The History of Money. That's the history of money, and it will give you a tremendous amount of information on the history of money, what's happened in other societies that have done exactly what we're doing, and where this whole thing is going to end up. You need to get the information. That's a little pamphlet called The History of Money, and it's available through Radio Liberty. We'll be back in just a moment with Ron Brown. Welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and we're talking really about what's going on in the economic system. And as you begin looking at this, you realize we're up to $3 billion a day. I mean, when Ron and I first started talking, a couple of years ago, we were borrowing $2 billion a day as a nation to pay our debts. Now we're up to $3 billion a day, and I suspect before long it'll be up to $4 or $5 billion a day, and that's fine as long as other countries will lend to you. But, you know, if your dollar is going to decrease in value, as the U.S. dollar is, why would anybody want to lend us dollars when they're repaid will be worth less than the interest that they've received? And so other countries, knowing full well what's going to happen to the dollar, will certainly want to get their funds out of the U.S. currency. And my concern is that, you know, if enough countries start doing this all at one time, America could be in real trouble. And you cannot, you know, separate our financial problems from the fact that our leaders are intent upon taking us to war with the rest of the Middle East. And think of the implications as far as the price of oil is concerned. If we were to attack Iran and they were to block the Straits of Hormuz there, and suddenly the price of oil went to $100 or to $150 a barrel, what would that do to our economy, to our trucking industry, to our airlines, to our farmers who are so dependent upon diesel fuel? I mean, well, we are on the edge of some very real problems, and once the cascade of collapse comes, it's going to simply wipe out, I fear, like a financial tsunami, so many of our people. Well, Ron, certainly, what are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with everything you're saying. An indication of the massive deception that's going on with the people. A couple of weeks ago, I don't know if you saw it, Dr. Stan, a congressman from Tennessee, James Cooper, I think was his name, came out with an article exposing the simple fact that the United States government keeps two sets of books. And the books that we get to see in the public is on the cash basis, and that shows the national debt somewhere around $8.2 to $8.4 trillion, which in itself is bad enough. But if you use the traditional or accepted accounting standards of the accrual basis, the set of books they keep for that, our national debt is right at $80 trillion. So when you start thinking about that, $80 trillion, how do you keep that system even afloat? And that's what's happening. The world is losing confidence in the dollar because, you know, anyone that abuses credit will be cut off, and that's exactly what's happening.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ron Brown, and simply talking about what's going on as far as the dollar is concerned. And Ron was saying that one of the congressmen came out recently. He thinks his name was Cooper, and that could very well be it. But he actually pointed out that our government is keeping two sets of books, just like so many crooked firms and the mafia. There's two sets of books, one you show to the public, and then the real set of books. And although they will tell us that the national debt is $8 trillion, well, it's really almost $9 trillion because we're spending like a drunken soldier, sailor when he first gets to port. But the real national debt is closer to $80 trillion, and I can believe that, having read some of the material put out by certainly some of the leading economists in this country. And that includes all the money that we promised to pay out that we have not funded. It includes all the money we've stolen from Social Security and from Medicare and from the Highway Trust Fund and from all the other trust funds. And, of course, they put Jimmy Baker in prison because he took money from one trust fund and used it in another. But what are we doing? What are our congressmen doing? They're doing just what Jimmy Baker did. Only he got a bad rap. Well, let's get back to it. Ron, why don't you get your telephone number and website out there and so people would know how they can get in touch with you and what the information they can get from you.
Sure. I've written a few letters on summarizing what I think is happening to the economy and what's going to happen with gold and silver and so forth. If anyone would like a free copy of that, just feel free to call me at 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
All right, fine. Again, our telephone number, if you have a question, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. One of the things I was most interested in is this Counterpunch article, which I just got today. I think it's dated the latter part of July. But they were commenting on the danger of derivatives. Now, derivatives are a bet on a bet on a bet, something of that sort, guaranteed that if a bet goes wrong, that somebody else will pick up the loss. But they were commenting that Enron, of Kenneth Lay fame, had used derivatives, of course, to guarantee that they wouldn't lose money with all of these fantastic investments they were going into, and it really worked very well for a time. But, of course, when the market turned against them and when the Indian government backed out of a deal for a couple of billion dollars, suddenly this whole house of cards began to teeter, and people know what happened to Enron. Of course, the people who had invested in Enron, because, of course, they were making so much money, and they were one of the outstanding energy companies in the entire world, and they were wheeling and dealing, and they were using derivatives to guarantee everything. And when the market turned against them, well, of course, many of the people there in key positions have gone to prison. But what the tragedy is so many, and not only the employees of Enron, but other gullible people who had invested their entire savings in Enron stock because it was doing so well and going up so rapidly, and they were getting rich literally overnight. Those people lost everything. And let me tell you that, you know, there's no free lunch. The one thing, if I can tell you, you know, and if you don't remember anything else, if you're here on Radio Liberty, remember the three rules of investing. Diversify, diversify, diversify. So with that as a background, Ron, what should people be doing right now?
Well, you know, just then you were talking about the latest clap. We've had other ones. We had long-term capital management back in the 90s. And then a while back, you had the Barron's Bank that went under, a 400-year-old bank that was bankrupted overnight because of derivatives. Then you had the Orange County catastrophe. When was that one? Time flies so much. That was back in the 90s, too.
Right.
So the folly of paper money at the latter stages of this inflationary cycle, you know, you create the euphoria for many, many years that you can get rich, invest in these paper investments on high leverage, but when the party's over, the market takes no prisoners. It just wipes people out overnight. So I think people need to start understanding that we're at the end of an economic cycle, a major economic cycle. In fact, I would say we're at the end of the monetary cycle for the United States. The dollar as we know it, which was actually created in 1913 when we went into this fractional reserve banking scam. If that's 1913, that's what, 90-something years. I think we're going into the last death throes of the U.S. dollar as we know it, that the dollar is being repudiated. The whole world knows we're in debt beyond our means, and the people are backing away from the dollar. So anyone that leaves all of their savings tied up in these dollar investments literally could get wiped out in a matter of a year or two. So throughout history, gold and silver has been honest money. It's been real money. It's not a debt of anyone. It's wealth in itself, and it's been cherished throughout the ages. So the refuge that people need to look to is gold and silver and different commodities and real things to get away from this high-leverage paper.
Well, somebody just called in and asked if this is going to lead to the new world order. In other words, is this economic dissolution of the value of our currency will lead to that? And I would like to suggest that this, what is happening, is not by accident. I think our leaders know exactly what they're doing. If they can collapse our economy, what will the American people do? if there's no food, if they don't have food, we've got, you know, we've got no jobs, we've got the insurance companies go under, the value of our homes, you know, is destroyed. What will the people do? They will look to government to solve their problem, just as they did back in the Great Depression. And with that will come the loss of freedom as we know it, and there will be no resistance at all to what our leaders really want. And I'm talking about the leaders of both political parties. They are dedicated to the destruction of America's national sovereignty. They are traitors to our nation. They want a one-world government. That's what it's really about. And so I certainly believe that's what's going to happen. A one-world economic system will not be able to rescue us. And, of course, we are going to see America transform from a first-world country into a third-world country. We'll take down our borders with Mexico, and we'll have the same economic prosperity that exists today south of the border. People say it couldn't happen here. Well, it's going to happen to most of the people. Yes, we will have some people who have made preparations who are going to do very well. The wealthy are not going to be hurt by this. They've already made all the preparations. Their money is invested throughout the world. Their money is in precious metals. Their money is in Swiss T-bonds or in Canadian T-bonds, and they'll move the money around to the countries that have stable currencies. But the average American who is not sophisticated, he's going to put his money in American T-bonds as the American dollar is dropping 10% in value a year, and he's getting 5% interest and has to pay taxes on that 5%. And he's smiling because he's so smart in being in a secure investment without understanding that when the value of the currency is destroyed, then the value of your savings are destroyed. And that's exactly what they want to do. And if you have not yet read Alan Greenspan's classic article in 1966, it is available up on the Internet. Just type on Google Alan Greenspan 1966 or Essay 1966 or Essay for Libertarians 1966 and read it through and understand that Alan Greenspan knows exactly what's going on in the world today. As he told Congressman Ron Paul several years ago, I recently read that article and I wouldn't change one word of it. And I think that's absolutely right. They know what it is. The warning is there. You need to read it, you need to heed it, and you begin to begin making your preparations for the financial tsunami that lies ahead. Our telephone number out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you're in a dangerous investment, cut your losses, get out, because I think down the line there got to be a lot more in the way of losses. Well, Ron, of course, certainly, you've got your ear to the ground. I'm sure you talk to lots of people every day about what's happening financially. What is the attitude of the sophisticated people you talk to?
Well, the people I talk to understand what's happening, and they're getting out of real estate. They're getting into gold and silver, getting into gold and silver shares and any type of commodity, base metals, copper, nickel, you know, buying. If anyone that are buying shares or stocks are buying those type and getting out of the banking stocks and so forth, the high-tech stocks. But, you know, going back to your other point, I'd like to just give two quotes that kind of point where we're going. David Rockefeller said, and I think Henry Kissinger said it in similar words, he said, "The world will not accept our new world order today, but given the right financial crisis, they will welcome us with open arms." And then back in 1994, I've shared this quote several times, this came right out of the United Nations, where they said, quote, "A world central bank is essential for the 21st century. It will take some time and probably an international crisis before we can achieve our goal of a world central bank." So, yes, I agree with what you were saying. All of this is being orchestrated to create the crisis so they can impose their solution. The latest thing on the horizon now, of course, is the Amero, where you can see they're orchestrating, and our president is making agreements with Mexico and Canada to set the stage for this new common currency. And what people you know, what really shocks me is that there is absolutely no outrage to people just talking about that. And what they don't realize is if we go to a common currency, by definition, as you just mentioned, we've given up our national sovereignty as a nation. We've given up this Constitution, and all the rights that we think we have because of the Constitution will be out the window. And so it's amazing how fast this thing is really starting to develop.
And I agree with you totally, and I think that the American people, at least those people who listen to our programs, some of them I know have made their preparations, and I hope the rest of them will. I think there are lots of things that you're going to have to do. I think things are moving at a fantastic rate right now. And if you read what the president is saying about the urgency of our attacking Iran, the urgency of our attacking Iran. What in heaven's name is he talking about? The Central Intelligence Agency says it'll be 5 to 10 years before they have the ability to create a nuclear weapon. That's exactly what they told us. We had to attack Iraq. They had weapons of mass destruction. They might, of course, be turned over to Al-Qaeda and used against us. We had to attack Iraq. And now we have to attack Iran. And who will we attack next, and how can we possibly defeat Iran? We can't defeat them militarily with a ground operation. We can't even bring peace and stability to Baghdad, much less to the great nation of Iran, which is 3 or 4 times the size of Iraq and has, you know, 4 times the population of Iraq. And the only solution, of course, would be nuclear weapons. The use of nuclear weapons. And ladies and gentlemen, if we use nuclear weapons in Iran, why, the genie will be out of the bottle, Pandora will be out of the box, the toothpaste will be out of the tube, and there'll be no getting it back in again. So, you know, you need to begin making preparations and hope and pray that what I'm saying is wrong, and I hope and pray it's wrong too, but the more I read, the more study I study, the more convinced I am of the fact that our leaders have an insane desire to go to war with Iran, or maybe they're being motivated by spiritual forces over which they have essentially no control. Well, we've got time for one more call at telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if we were to go to war, I fear that, and especially, of course, if there were to be, you know, then repercussions as far as our troops in Iraq is concerned, or there would be the use of chemical and or biological weapons, and believe me, Saddam's chemical and biological weapons are there in Syria and perhaps even in the Bekaa Valley, waiting to be used against our troops and waiting to be used against Israel. Something of that sort could simply begin to collapse the entire world economic system. Now, what specific products do you recommend for the small investor, Ron?
Well, as you know, Dr. Stan, I believe silver is the safest play and the investment that gives you the best chance of hitting an economic or financial home run. I believe silver will outperform gold a minimum of 5-1 over the next 2 years. In other words, if you bought gold and doubled your money, if you had bought silver instead, you would have made 5 times on your money. So I really believe we're approaching a once-in-a-world history phenomenon where the world has literally consumed over the last 60 years the silver that took 4,000 years to accumulate. And as we run out of that stockpile that we've been consuming for the last 60 years, we're getting down to the bottom of the barrel at the very moment when all these financial and monetary instabilities are starting to come to the surface, and all of a sudden, on top of that already tight demand for industrial silver, you're going to see monetary demand explode as people run for the exits to try to get out of their failing paper currencies. So I think you could see silver just literally explode over the next 2 years.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Eric, his colleague from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Hi, Doc. How you doing?
I haven't heard from you in some time. How you been?
I'm out here listening, though.
Okay.
How you doing, Mr. Brown?
How you doing?
I'm fine. I'm just fine, thanks. You know, you guys, give me some type of what would you suggest as a strategy to try and get people to open their eyes? You know, you have the liberals who don't have a clue, and then you have the conservatives who think they have a clue, but they're listening to people like your Rush Limbaughs and your Dennis Prager's, and they just really don't get it. These guys are telling them everything's okay, everything's going to be fine. They love George Bush. He calls himself a Christian, but if you see, you know, if you look what he does, you can tell he's not. But they believe in this guy, and they're all for war. What do you say to these people to try and get them to open their eyes?
Well, what would you say to them, Ron? How would you answer Eric's question?
I'm not sure. I have an answer, but I did run across something just in the last 2 weeks. Tex Mars, in his latest newsletter, the title of it, The Murder of America, The Plot to Dissolve the United States and Establish a North American Union. Now, if any of us went and quoted Tex Mars saying this is what's going to happen, people would look at us like we're Looney Tunes, right? They would just write us off. But on the front page of his newsletter, he has a picture of the booklet put out by the Council on Foreign Relations. And the title is Building a North American Community. You can order that booklet. I don't have the number to order, but...
You can actually pull it down free of charge off of the Council on Foreign Relations website, too.
Okay. So what I would say, if you're trying to convince people that all this is going on behind the scenes, and you quote other conservatives, it's too easy to write those off as just a wild radical.
Hold this off right there. All right, go ahead, Ron.
But if you show it to them in the writing and the plans of the very people that are planning this, let's face it, what percentage of our congressmen and people up in Washington are members of the Council on Foreign Relations? So if you could show people that here's what the Council on Foreign Relations is planning, then it has more legitimacy than if you just come across as a radical. We're all radicals to someone who's not looking at the truth.
I think, Eric, you certainly want to get a copy of my next newsletter. That's the August newsletter, where I simply quote from Richard Harwood's article on the Council on Foreign Relations. Richard Harwood was the editor of the Washington Post for many years, and then as the Working as the mediator for the Washington Post. Why? He wrote this article in October of 1993, which we can send you a copy of if you request it. Basically he tells about the Council on Foreign Relations, their control over our government. When you read it, you realize the president was a member, the secretary of state was a member, three undersecretaries of state, the deputy secretary of state, the secretary of defense, the secretaries of housing and education and welfare. All of the people in key positions in government came from the Council on Foreign Relations, the head of the CIA, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank. He lists it all there. It's a great article. And, of course, I'll be quoting it in my August newsletter. And then he asked the people to check it out and find out if it's true. If it really is true, why have you never heard this? What do these people want? They want a world government. Eric, I think if you can get people to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or if you can get them to watch the video, but if you can't, simply ask them, why did we really go to war with Afghanistan? Because it certainly wasn't to get Osama bin Laden. Why were they so anxious to go to war with Iraq, when, of course, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction? Why do they want to go to war with Iran? And what happens if Iran... were to attack America? I mean, what happens if there are terror cells all throughout America that have been here for many years, and our government knows about them and is going to allow them to disrupt our society? Just ask them the question and let them think about that for a while. Then if they want the documentation on that, you can show them the video that came out in 1994, was suppressed by intelligence agencies, entitled Jihad in America. If you haven't seen it, it's well worthwhile watching.
Real quick, I've been listening to talk radio for years, and I would always...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment, Eric. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've got Eric calling from Compton. Go ahead, Eric.
Just very quickly, I've been listening to talk radio for years when the liberals were in control, when Clinton was president for 8 years, and I always argue that how the left was taking us to the one-world government faster than the right, or this, the left-right thing, and then Bush got to be president, and it was still full steam ahead. It got even faster, which truly should let people know that the people that run the world do really control both sides.
You're absolutely right. All we can do, Eric, is just pray for the people, pray that something will open up their eyes. But I think as things get worse, economically, people are going to begin looking for answers, especially if we get into war with Iran, especially as the economy begins to contract, especially as these people lose their jobs or lose their property rights. Or, you know, somebody very close to them that comes down with a chronic illness for which there is no effective treatment. At that point, people begin looking a little differently. And, of course, the problem is we've got it so good, most people aren't concerned about what's going on. They will be sooner or later. Let's hope it's sooner than later.
I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to have to hit them close to home first.
And remember, it's a spiritual battle. Our job is to point people in the right direction. It's only God that's got to open up their eyes.
Hey, I love you guys. God bless you.
God bless you too, Eric.
Bye-bye,
Eric.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Ron, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
I always enjoy being with you, Dr. Stan.
God bless, and thanks so much. And, of course, I want to mention for all of our listeners out there, we are having a conference on October the 29th. That's a Sunday. It's going to be out at the Aptos Seascape. You're going to have to call and make your reservations ahead of time. We want to know how many people are coming. We're serving lunch. So that's the 29th of October. We're going to have Constance Gumby. We're going to have Chris Pitto. We're going to have Barrett Schoss and a lot of other favorites here. It's going to be a great conference. We hope you can make it. And so the 29th of October, that's a Sunday, and Aptos Seascape, and it, of course you can come to Santa Cruz. We'll kind of have some rooms available at a reduced rate at one of the close-by hotels. This is a beautiful part of the world to be, especially at that time of year. So, again, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We just want to mention that we do carry the Berkey products, and if you want to get them, why, of course, you get them through us. Why, you'll get a four-tape set or a video that we've produced. We hope that many of you will be interested in getting my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or, of course, you can get other information through Radio Liberty. Right now, we're encouraging people to get a new book we're carrying called Hostage to the Devil. It's a book that helped to change my life back in 1980 when I first read it. It was written by Malachi Martin. We haven't carried it until recently, but we think it's a very important book. And of course, you'll want to get help Malachi Martin's four-tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, along with that, so you'll know a little bit about the man who wrote it and about what's really going on in the Vatican and about the smoke of Satan that circulates over the top of the Vatican. This is written by a Jesuit priest, so it'll give you real insight into so much of what's going on. And then, of course, our videos, the new video, The Rape of the Soul. And once again, this is put out by a conservative Catholic about pornographic art in the Catholic Church and obscene art in the Catholic Church and what happened when he went to Rome to try to report what was going on. And about the death threats which he's received. Well, he doesn't talk about that in the movie, but we've talked to Michael Colacci a number of times, and he's been under tremendous pressure since he tried to bring out the truth about what's really going on and the battle for the minds of the Catholics in this country. But believe me, the same thing is going on in the Protestant church today. There is a conspiracy against God. And right now, of course, the average Christian has no idea what's going on. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't gotten my four-tape set on Financial Armageddon, if you haven't got my talk on the Financial Tsunami, available either in DVD or video, and then, of course, our Financial Tsunami syllabus, let me recommend that. And then, of course, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. And our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
asking questions. There are many people asking why. There are many people paying attention. There are many now who see the big lie.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. This is Joyce, and Dave is on business elsewhere, so we get to talk about the news today. I thank you for joining us. If you have not turned on your television set, well, here's what you're going to hear. The security alert has been raised to red on planes coming from the UK to the US, and possibly here in the US also. You need 2 hours to get to the airport.